Blog Talk Radio.
Here comes the time for joy and love, understanding, opening our eyes to see that the Gula, the redemption, is on its way in a very quick way, in a peaceful, pleasant way. Good morning to everyone. That was Isaac Batone's already classic, Comes the Time, from his Generation Redemption album. Good morning. This is Danza Skubin. You're somewhat late. humble cyberspace. Torah activist, and we have on the line, we have our teacher, advocate, and very patient human being, Dennis Ryan, for waiting an extra minute and 27 seconds to, like, got the show running, and of course, our Noahide Chassid, Ron Williams. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning, Don and Ron.
Good morning, Dennis and Don.
Before we open up the show, I just want to remind everyone that there's a concept I'll say it in the Hebrew, then I'll translate it. Todir sha'ona, todir, todir kodem. That when we're accustomed to doing something on a regular basis, it precedes something which we don't do on a regular basis. So normally, if we have the show queued up at 8 o'clock in the evening, we're pretty regular. But since we're doing it at 9:30 in the morning, because my son doesn't have yeshiva this morning, he gets a chance to rest up, take a little break. I wasn't so regular, and therefore I was a little late. But let's just start off the show by reminding everyone that Soul Class is a class dedicated to opening up the human mind towards the normative seven universal commandments, the seven Noahide commandments, the Sheva Mitzvot B'nai Noach, which is alluded to in the name of our show, Soul, which is an acronym for S7O, oldest, U, universal, as we just mentioned, the seven Noahic commandments, which will say state out very tersely, and then we'll invite you all humbly to do your own research on the matter, and then eventually, if you want to, you can call up, we can talk about it on the air or off the air. So number one, we should not blaspheme the Creator with the Creator's name. Number two, we should not commit acts of idolatry. Number three, not to commit acts of premeditated murder. Four, not to commit acts of adultery. Five, not to steal. Six, not to eat the limb of an animal while it's still alive. Number seven, to raise up righteous statutes, which are normative to the human mind. Not something, these are not mystical matters. These are matters such as educating. Educating everyone should have access to an education which will enrich them in their lives on this blessed earth, to encourage people to do tzedakah, acts of kindness, and as per their need, because the Torah commandment for prayer is that any person who has a need should pray directly to the Creator, not through intermediaries, the sun, moon, stars, or even human beings for that matter. So we just want to give a little segue into what we hope to cover today. We, as humble indigenous descendants of the dust, as written in Genesis chapter 2, verse 7, and then the Lord God formed man of the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living soul. And so therefore we want to keep on sharing with you, blessed souls, meditations of gratitude towards the Most High, as well as we want to serve up for your spiritual palate, mind, heart, and soul teachings about Rambam, or from Rambam, Rabbi Nachman, the path of righteous Gentile, compassion for humanity in the Jewish tradition, and the Rebbe's of the Chabad Hasidus movement, and plus stimulating dialogue to encourage and not discourage you, blessed soul, to gain greater. I wrote in the promo guitar. I guess that shows you how awake I was when I wrote it. Greater awareness of your divine image. Ron and Dennis, Dennis and Ron, I'd like to share with you, and of course your feedback would be most welcome, as we continue with these brief discussions about the importance of a human being human by virtue of the fact that he or she will think positively. So I'm going to pull out from this little book here, booklet, hopefully it will be translated into English, called Chashuv Tov, Think Good. And I think we began to talk about this last week, but we'll review a concept, and then we'll share some new material, that a person, most people who are thinking in a quote-unquote normal way or a socially friendly way, try to dress up appropriately when they go out into society. But what a person cannot do is that they cannot change themselves, meaning a 6'2" human being cannot turn himself into a 5'2" human being and vice versa. So therefore, we can learn out that just as there are physical garments to the human experience, there are also spiritual garments to the human experience, which we're taking it from a more inner dimension perspective. The human experience on this earth is by what our soul is interacting with, and our soul is enclothing itself in our garments, but these are spiritual garments. They are, one spiritual garment can be the garment of thought, one spiritual garment can be the act of speech, and another spiritual garment is action. And I remember, maybe, it's probably before you came to America, Ron, but maybe, Dennis, you remember a commercial that used to be on the television, probably in the early 70s, where they would show different types of individuals, like serving a hot dog, and he would put a little toothpick with his name and said, this hot dog was made by Franco, or the tire was changed by Gene, or the or the window was cleaned by Billy. I don't know if you remember such a commercial, but I remember such a thing. And I think it was a public service announcement that people should try to take pride in what they're doing. So when we're thinking good, we should try to take pride in the fact that we are empowered at that very moment, and in a very existential moment, because, you know, a person's early life, present life, and future life is based on how do they move from moment to moment. And although, as we talked about last week, we really can't control the flow of our thoughts, we can redirect them, and we become masters of these matters. We can actually transform them as catalysts into very high levels of positive thinking to elevate ourselves and others who interact with us and feel that we are in an elevated state. I'm not talking about super-duper spirituality, but a positive-minded person. People like to be with positive-minded person. Now, one thing, the new point I want to bring out is that when the soul encloses itself in the body, it is not the totality of the soul. It is merely, so to speak, a dripping or a dropping down from a higher place within the creation, which it's hard to pinpoint where that physical place is, because the soul is not a physical matter, just as the Most High is not a physical matter, yet we know from testimony of the prophet of Isaiah that his glory fills the whole earth. So we should understand that we are just getting enough energy to empower our awareness from our soul. Ultimately, it's coming down to the conduit of our divine image, and therefore we should have a sense of appreciation, the fact that we can be conscious at any one moment of a positive thought at that one point, and then hopefully that will empower us to move on to the next good thought. Dennis, I said a lot, so I expect you to say something very, very good. Whether you agree or disagree, by the way.
Oh, I agree 100%. As a matter of fact, we had a television evangelist in America here for many years, almost two decades, and his name was Dr. Norman Vincent Peale, and he wrote a bestseller book, and it was called The Power of Positive Thinking. And that was the basis for his television evangelistic program. And all he did was just talk about the positive side of your mind. And I guess a lot of people heard it. I don't know what the total impact is, but that was one person who was trying to make a difference. Yes, if your mind is full of good thoughts, it's going to come out. You can't hide it. If it's full of bad thoughts, you can't hide it or disguise it for too long. It's going to come out. But since we all have a free will, we must emphasize what our conscience tells us to do. And our conscience says it's far better to be nice than to be nasty. It's far better to think of good things than bad things. And we must reinforce this. And that's why we have the Torah, the Bible, and other things to help us reason out some of these things as to what is good or bad. But we must be constantly be reminded of this. It's very easy to think of bad things, especially if you're angry. But can you concentrate on thinking of good things is the real question. And your fellow man depends on that. God is waiting for it.
Mm-hmm. Dennis, I expected something good. You gave me something great. Thank you very much. Ron, I know you are a student very much of the process of thought as it relates to the soul and how the soul relates to thought. What is your... I'm sure when you share some of your thoughts with right now, it will be a soulful discussion.
Well, if I can catch my breath, because I just finished doing my interval exercise. It's a new type of exercise where I bring myself to total exhaustion. And I decided to wake myself up this morning by doing that to be ready for the show. Instead, I'm so exhausted, you won't believe it. Anyway, one of the things we're aware of the fact that coming from a Christian background, that you know there's Satan and there's God and you know there's good and evil and everything, but we always thought of this as somewhat outside of us. Is that Satan has his place and you know God has his place and we have to make a choice where to go. Mm-hmm. Except for when I started studying Judaism and especially Hasidus, where I started understanding that the good inclination, that good side of us, that godly side of us is actually inside of us. But also due to the fact of the sin of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, we now kind of like ingested also the evil, that evil inclination inside of us. So we have constantly this two inclinations always trying to, you know, dominate. And we have to make the choice which of the two we're going to, like, you know, allow. As a result, we also have the thought process coming into a body which has these two opposite tendencies. And we find that if we do a lot more soul search, we turn towards more spiritual aspect of our being, in terms of acquiring more knowledge, in terms of spirituality, wanting to know more about God, we find that we have like a stronger control over the negative, as opposed to if we just allow ourselves to just be basically in between, then we have an influx of either one, and obviously living in a physical world, that can dominate most of the time. So right now, as Dennis was bringing out his point, I realized that a person basically doesn't always make the choice of being a certain way. They just allow themselves, in terms of, in a very passive way of allowing their thoughts to develop without checking, keeping them in check. And as a result, many times a person might act a certain way or even say things, and when you actually speak to them, they reveal a side of them which is it's actually very good. But they just allow themselves to go in a direction which is not good. And what we have to do, and what I think this class is, and what you, myself, and Dennis are trying to do, is to awaken people to the fact that they do have control, and they must take control this process. And the basis for this is just acquiring knowledge of God, of spirituality, of goodness, because this will essentially dominate their entire thought process. And you find that before you start this process, many thoughts have come to you that before you would accept, you really see the ugliness of it. And naturally you repel these thoughts. In the beginning, it will be a process where you have to, no, I really don't want to think about this anymore. Not now. This is not right. After a while, it becomes so repulsive, you don't need to allow a discussion of whether you should allow it or not. You just repel it like, automatically. But this comes from acquiring knowledge, because you need to strengthen that godly side to be able to dominate the opposite.
Beautiful, Ron. But I think also, too, it's a process of, you know, I think that many people, and I've also fallen into this trap, I want to be very careful about this, is that when we talk about spirituality, something which appears at first glance to be very ethereal, untouchable, unseeable, unsmellable, undigestible, still we're processing concepts which, you know, Dennis has brought up many times, we're speaking in human language, which is an empowerment of consciousness, but it also limits our consciousness. But the fact of the matter is, this is God's will that we communicate. Like, for instance, we are communicating now in English. So there are concepts that we're sharing with people that perhaps they've never accessed in English. At the same time, too, we at some point in time might want to, you know, learn a little bit more. For instance, say like in the, and again, this is not to people that all everyone sign up for a Hebrew course, but there's just certain things that don't necessarily translate. But that's okay, because the reason why I keep on doing this is I think that the conversations are vital, and they're potent, and you know, gentlemen, you should know I get positive feedback from people from California, from the Deep South. There's a poet I don't think I mentioned these, Dennis, if not on the air or off the air, that there happens to be a poet down in, I think either in South Carolina or in Florida, who is very, very much in tune to what you're talking about. So, you know, we're reaching out, but when we reach out with, say, these concepts, which appear to be people to be spirituality, but the spirituality is being experienced through our minds and in our hearts, and our minds or our brains are physical entities, and our hearts are physical entities. And when we speak, we're actually there's a projection of physical energy coming outside of our mouth, because if you talk and you put your hand in front of your mouth, you feel a breath. That's a physical breath, or an exhalation, you might want to call it, coming out. So in anything that's in physicality, there's always a process of refinement. Nothing really is ultimate in its state of perfection until the due time when, say, the Creator calls us back home to go to the next level of life, as some people would call it, death. Or you see that on a seashore, there's a sea jetty that might have been set up 100 years ago, so it was washed down, so they replaced it with a new sea jetty. So consciousness or spirituality, we have to try to remind people as well, gentlemen, I think, and anyone listening out there, it's not just something outside of us. It is part of our physical existence. And proof of that is the fact that we see that, you know, spirituality is very much embedded in the physicality of the world by the very first verse in the Torah, which is where it says, in the beginning, the Most High created the heaven and the earth. Now, the earth, of course, the heaven is, seems to be a little more ethereal, but hey, there's physical bodies out there. There's stars, and there's suns, and there's moons, and there's planets. And of course, we can all testify we're living a physical life on a physical planet. So Dennis, what do you think about this idea that how we, it might help us and others to explain to people that spirituality is not invisible, it's actually part of our physical lives, it's more the elevated aspect of our lives?
Well, thanks for opening the door, Don. However, spirituality comes in two parts. One, from the individual, and the other, from interaction with other humans. And for some reason or another, humans tend to be a little lazy. And they like this group concept. Why? Because they think it excuses them from personal spirituality. So when somebody says, oh yes, I do that once a week, I'm with other people, we all have share our spirituality, and it lasts for the moment while we're in a holy place, etc. But they forget, it must go on. You must bring it with you. You must practice it every day. It's in you. So don't use the excuse that, oh yes, I went to a religious service once a week or twice a week or whatever the number is, and feel like you don't have to think about spirituality anymore. Wrong, wrong, wrong. What happens is the personal spirituality is far greater than the group. Why? Because you are talking or communicating directly with God. That is a sacred, holy communication. And you must treat it with the highest human respect. Now, when you do it with other humans, that's nice, but it doesn't suffice to say that you are excused from doing it on a personal basis. So humans, and I'm one of them, we tend to be a little lazy. And it's far easier to say, oh, I did it with the group last week. That's not good enough. Every day that you live, you should communicate with God. No matter how small it is, you should.
True. And Dennis, this is also proven out in verses in the Tanakh and the prophets that we see that it was the individual heartfelt prayer of the mother of Samuel, the prophet, Hannah, who prayed, who was in such pain that she was still childless, that her prayer came out. And most of, when King David wrote his Psalms, he didn't write that or sing them initially in the congregation. Well, there might have been, he might have had instantaneous divine inspiration or prophetic insight. But a lot of his Psalms were written when he was on the run, when he was in solitude. So we see that, you know, what your words are borne out from the very written verses. And also we see Moses. There were individual prayers made by Moses away from the congregation of Israel. And I'm sure, you know, the righteous of all the nations have also had bona fide experiences which they share with their students or written down for the ages, that they made certain prayers and they saw that their prayers were answered precisely because they believed in that wireless connection before we had the cell phone technology of just them and the Almighty Creator. Ron, your take on this, on trying to help people understand that spirituality is actually within our physical living experience, and maybe anything else that you can pluck out from what Dennis and I are talking about to accent it with your unique style of elucidation.
I remember the in the book of Genesis, I remember the exact chapter and verse when it says Noah walked with God, and it said walk with God. We know that God is not a physical being to accompany him physically on his journey. We know that basically meant that God was within Noah's thoughts. You know, Noah thought of God, but he walked with God. God was with him all the time. And that just tells us that he was in constant communication with the Creator. And I think what happens now to us is because of the fact that we're so, you know, deeply immersed in the mundane, in physicality, and acquiring what we think we need to survive, which is sometimes a lot more than we actually do need. But but we are so invested that we feel that this is of vital importance, because of course if we don't live or exist how we want, you know, how can we, you know, have a chance to serve the Creator? But what happens is that it becomes after a while an indulgence more than anything else, and it becomes hard to carve out that time to be quiet enough to listen to ourselves, much less to have a communication of that sort with the Creator. So many times when we find we form in groups, you know, well, then I agree with 1,000% possible, because we feel that once we're in a group, there's always someone who takes the lead and who kind of brings us to that space where we have to be quiet and start a communication. But of course, as soon as we leave the group, it feels good and kind of like energizes us for you, and we can go on that to the rest of the week. So then it's 100% on the button. It's something that we have to do. We have to be connected to the Creator every day, and if possible, I mean, it is possible, all day, by just involving the Creator within our mundane activities. Some people feel that, you know, God is to be reserved for a special day, and a special time, and a special frame of mind. What they don't realize is that God is supposed to be with us within everything that we do. You know, that's why it says that, you know, know God in all that you do. You didn't say know God in your spiritual devotions or only when you're communicating with Him. All that you do, all we do is physical. We're physical beings in this world. So we have to be able to incorporate that in our everyday, hourly life.
Sure. Beautiful, then. I just want to mention two things
Don?
Yes, Dennis.
Let me just finish up on that Ron's thought. And it comes from American Puritans, believe it or not, when the country was originally founded. And what happens is they emphasize this verse of Genesis 5 through 24. And I'll read it, and it's a short one. It says, mm-hmm. And Enoch walked with God, and he was not, for God took him. So this concept of walking with God has been around the United States for a long time. But do people really understand it is the real question.
Well, I would like to say this. Do people really understand it? I think that all of us, if we look at ourselves and look at each other as works in progress, I hope that most people would say that they're getting a greater understanding of this concept as they mature, as they grow older. But any person who would profess to say, oh, I have full understanding of that concept, well, they're testifying that they're not interested, gave up on the idea, or at some level they reject such a concept. So that's what I have to say about that. What I want to bring out before we're going to ask Dennis to turn to his wonderful book about Maimonides, the Baal Shem Tov taught, Rabbi Yisrael Baal Shem Tov, had a very interesting perspective which led to the opening up and development of the Hasidic movement, which is primarily an educational movement, contrary to the way most people look at it, unfortunately, that he said, after a person prays, whether it be communal prayer, individual prayer, they should not just get up from the place where they prayed, but they should actually linger. I don't recall if he said for how much time, for several moments at least, because by the virtue of the fact that a person prayed, they generated a certain level of energy around themselves. And therefore, they can take a couple of moments to reflect, what did I accomplish now in my praying to the Almighty, to God? And can I take what I've generated outside of myself by virtue of my speech? Because Jewish liturgical prayer or just praying out to God, we humbly suggest to everyone that you can accomplish just the same, if not more, by speaking out your prayers. It's just in the mind process, but a person can certainly pray with just their mind and their thought process. But by speaking out words of supplication and praises and requests, because we're allowed to ask the Most High for our needs, because ultimately we should be proud bearers of testimony that we prayed to the Most High for what we really needed, and he gave it to us because we prayed for it, because that is the Torah commandment, to pray for what you need. So therefore, we can take it that experience and take it out, energize. What came from within us is now outside of us, so to speak, and we can, so to speak, meditate on absorbing whatever positivity we accomplish, and then hopefully take it out of our houses of prayer or our houses of study or our plain houses, or you can pray in the street as well. There's no real restriction aside from the fact that we just humbly advise people that it is better to pray where people are clothed in a humble manner, in a modest manner, I should say, not humble, a modest manner, and to stay away from anything that would have a bad smell, like, say, animal feces or even, you know, human waste. So I just want to share that point. And with that point, Dennis, if you can pull out Moses Maimonides, Physician, Scientist, and Philosopher, which is edited by Dr. Rosner and Dr. Samuel S. Kotek. I guess we're going to be picking up on Developmental Perspective, page 55.
You got it.
So read away, and we're all ears, and hopefully Ron
all
and
right.
I will chime in.
Let me just preface this. It's called Developmental Perspective, but my personal opinion is this is a bridge that Maimonides created between the static historical viewpoint compared to the dynamic modern viewpoint today. So it's one is theory, the other is practice. And Maimonides takes a different viewpoint. So let me read. It says, modern psychology and psychiatry has mental health as its primary goal. For Maimonides, mental health, as defined by the healthy soul, is merely the means of a stepping stone toward achieving the ultimate goal, which is the intellectual knowledge of God. In Shimona Perikim and Hilchot Deot, Maimonides' goal is to enhance the development of the self, which is the ability to moderate passions, drives, and needs in the service of God. In The Guide to the Perplexed, the ideal is not the development of the healthy soul, but rather the subordination of self, both body and soul, in the service of the highest perfection, the intellectual knowledge of God, to the point where all action and thought is dispassionate and derives directly from transcendent closeness with God, not from one's own moral character, ethical standards, and psychological health. In other words, the real mental health for Maimonides is achieved when man is no longer concerned with mental health of the self at all. To achieve this level, however, one must have attained a healthy inner character, a sense of self, to be able to provide a sound basis for further development. In normal development, both psychological and physiological, each new stage of development is predicated upon the previous stage having been achieved. In Maimonides' terms, the healthy body and soul are essential prerequisites for the ultimate goal of being able to transcend them in the pursuit of highest perfection. The healthy soul of the wise man, described in Shimon Perikim and in the Hilchot Deot, with its emphasis on moderation and balance of middle way, is a necessary precursor and stepping stone for man to achieve the level of pious or saintly man described in the Hilchot Deot, which moves off center to an extreme in his quest for knowledge of God. The pious or saintly character may then be necessary level for the achievement of Maimonides' highest level, as described in the guide 354. The total identification with the intellectual knowledge of God, with concomitant negation of any concern for one's own physical and psychological self. Maimonides is presenting a blueprint of stages of religious development as well as all developmental schema. Maimonides understands that not everyone reaches the highest level, although it is the ultimate goal. This perspective may also help to explain why Maimonides reverses himself in the Hilchot Deot regarding anger and pride, demanding an extreme negation of these emotions rather than the balanced middle way. The power of anger and pride have two detrimental an effect on man's ability to transcend the self and therefore be dealt with in a more extreme fashion. Maimonides, the man, the practical physician, the healer of the soul as well as of the body, was aware that most people are unable to achieve the highest level espoused in the guide. He addressed the guide to his pupil, Yosef ben Yehuda, someone he believes has at least the possibility of achieving the highest level of perfection. Maimonides does not diminish or negate the efforts of those who are struggling to develop a healthy body with an inner self of balance and self. And for them, he provides the guidelines for achieving knowledge of God in the Sheminol Perakim and the Hilkat Deot. These levels of religious development may also provide an insight into Maimonides' own personal religious, ethical, and moral development.
Beautiful. And it's funny that I started to intuit, Dennis, as you were reading, having not read, because instead of preparing by knowing what you're going to read for the following week, I wanted to come as a surprise to me to see it, to try to work with my own awareness of his teachings, that I got the feeling that the Shmona Prochim, which is something we've touched on in the past in our classes, eventually we'll get back to it, which is basically 8 prefatory chapters on how to fulfill the teachings of ethics of the sages, 6 chapters of 5 chapters of Mishnah, 1 of Braisa, and Hilchos Deot, which is more than normative. See, basically, as I understand it, the entranceway into getting towards this level of human actualization would start with the plain and black and white halacha, which is in Hilchot Deot, because basically he intended that everyone should be able to access the Torah in the most clear-cut fashion. That's why he wrote the Mishnah Torah. Now, Shmona Prochim is already dealing with how to prepare oneself to ascend to more pious behavior. Now, pious behavior means one has to see one's shortcomings and try to rectify them, which he talks about in the Shmona Prochim, and also to grasp onto the good that person has actually attained in this world. And then in that process, okay, there can be confusion, there can be perplexity. So comes along Rambam and writes the Guide to the Perplexed, which I was not aware of such an issue that apparently Rambam was very selective in seeing with his, of course he was a great sage, that whoever this Yosef ben Yehuda is, which I apologize, I don't know who he is, but apparently it was one of his students, that could reach the highest levels of perfection as the human experience can experience in the Guide to the Perplexed. So it's basically, these are like, if anyone has played a computer game, sometimes there's the beginner's level, then there's the intermediate level, and then the expert level. And the truth of the matter is that, you know, I myself have struggled with the Guide to the Perplexed, and that's why I'm more involved in learning the Shmona Prochim and the Hilchot Deot. But say someone like Dennis, who is a little bit older than me, and came to it without any reservations of the fact he wanted to get this knowledge of this great sage, is able to access it, as opposed to say I have a certain background in other teachings which I'm trying to work on the first 2 levels. And that's just a little insight into how I look at these 3 teachings, and this is very illuminating for my eyes, Dennis and Ron. So maybe I'll pass the ball to Ron, and then we'll let Dennis make a concluding statement based on what I've just had to say, and maybe what Ron has to say. Ron?
I myself purchased the Hilchot Deot, the Laws of Personality Development.
Mm-hmm.
And I, recently, under your advice, I bought the Shmona Perakim.
Mm-hmm.
I never quite understood. I always felt that, you know, certain caricatures are inborn, and basically it's virtually impossible to change it because actually who we are as people. But reading this and trying to internalize the ideas, the concepts, I realized that it's our behavior that kind of form our habits, and not vice versa. So really, if we just start by directing our behavior in a certain direction, we will have our negative traits and negative character traits more aligned with our behavior, which makes it actually easier to change them if it was the opposite way around. So what this book allowed me to access that type of thinking, where I can actually change myself by just the way I behave. So
true.
I've never read the Guide to the Perplexed, so I basically have no idea what the Rambam was bringing out there. I learned it actually basically from Dennis, as the narrator of the release.
Dennis, any feedback based on what we're saying?
Yes. What happens if you want to understand Maimonides, you must understand his dynamic perception. And his dynamic perception is directed to various different levels of development. And he still creates an umbrella as for the direction to go. The question I have personally was, if he was never a physician, would he still come out the same ideas? But that's me thinking to myself. But anyway, it happened. He is a physician, and he understood all previous written histology of religious concepts and ideas. And what he ended up doing is creating this dynamic or combination so that he doesn't negate the past, but he accepts what the future will bring. And to me, that's a very powerful concept. However, to all our listeners, you're going to have to wait for the next small chapter called The Position of the Soul as to where the wrap-up will be regarding Maimonides and mental health.
And we'll add with an asterisk, it will be a wrap-up that will be dynamic, not static. Okay, gentlemen, we've reached almost like the halfway point, so I'd like to take our little musical segue with Rabbi Lazer Brody. And Ron, I hope you'll be able to stand because we do want to go into the path of Rashi Gentile. Usually it's about the time you cut halfway through, but since it's not 8:45 at night, it's only 10:12 in the morning. Hope you'll stay on, okay? So we're gonna go into the wheat field. This is a song by Rav Brody from his Calming Waters album, which was released last year. Hold on, everyone, and we're gonna take a break for about 3 to 4 minutes. Hold on, please. Enjoy. Thank you.
And that was Wheat Field by Rob Laser Brody, and that was from his album Calming Waters. And one of the things I like about that music, gentlemen, is myself having lived on a farm or farms for almost 3 years of my life and living on the side of a mountain up in the ancient city of Sfat, Israel. I can just tell you, this music was really capturing the taste. If anyone has never lived on a farm for an extended period of time, I mean, maybe you took a day trip to a farm, the sounds of apparently he was trying to replicate in a song of walking on straw or walking on hay as one goes to see the animals or walking by a brook or hearing the frogs croak. This brings my mind back and my soul back within my mind to those days where I spent wonderful contemplative times living on farms. And I would suggest, you know, people like to go away to big fancy hotels and pampered. Okay, if they want to, they want to. But if you ever have a chance, blessed souls, you have a chance to spend a week on a farm, you get a different perspective on life. When instead of walking from your lodgings, where I don't know where you would find such a place, but are there such lodgings where you can be by close to a farm, where you walk on a dirt road to your next place of meeting, whether it be the breakfast hall or the gym or the or wherever it may be, to rendezvous with friends or family or the people who you're staying by, it's a wonderful experience to just walk on a dirt road and think slow thoughts, positive thoughts. And that's just the emotions that are swelling up with me as I listen to music such as that. We're going on to our next section. Before we get to The Path of Resident Gentile and Compassion for Humanity in the Jewish Tradition by Rabbi David Sears, I forgot to mention that we should also start off with going to the chapter 6 in the Ethics of Our Fathers, which the next attribute to help us not just learn, but to learn Torah or learn scripture or oral tradition in a way that we internalize them. The wonderful teachings of Rabbi Nachman instruct us how to better understand on a deeper level. The next attribute to help us acquire Torah is called Ohev Et Haimasharim. Now, the root of the word Mesharim is Yashar, means straight. So what this instruction is to help us understand how we can better learn and internalize the Torah is that we should love the straight way, the straight path. And what is the straight path? So Rabbi Nachman says, you should know, my beloved and my son, that it's not possible to comprehend to attain an acquisition of Torah except when a person seeks the truth within the context they want to get to the truth of that teaching that they're learning, and to clarify for themselves what is the proper judgment that emanates out, meaning what can be the instruction from what any verse in the five books of Moses or the writings of the prophets or the holy writings such as Psalms or Proverbs or Ecclesiastes, and that anything that a person learns, the person still, even though they're looking at what they consider to be with their total faith that this is the truth, still a person must clarify for him or herself, again, what to take out of it to emulate and to exemplify within one's own lifestyle judgments or ordinances with one's own personal day-to-day conduct of how to act in a straight, correct manner. And he said that as Rabbi Nachman says, when a person learns, the essence is to do an investigation and to meditate, to do an analysis within their own understanding, to understand it very well what they're learning, and then to take out of it the pathway they should go in terms of how do they, for instance, let's take for example the first verse in Psalms. The first verse in Psalms by King David is a person. Let me just pull it out here. Fortunate is the person who does not go in the ways of. Let me just get it there. Who does not go in the advice of the wicked or in the way of sinners, and does not stand, and he doesn't stand in the way of sinners, and in a gathering place of mockers, he will not sit. So we have three categories. We have people involved, unfortunately, in wicked behavior, or people doing sinful behavior, or people who are mockers. So then a person has to look at this verse and say, well, what would I consider to be wicked conduct? What would I consider to be sinful conduct?
And what's the type of conduct or gathering of people who would be a gathering of mockers that King David is warning me, advising me that I should avoid their company. So that's where we have to go into each one of us, to go into our own unique perspectives, whether we can learn, and we humbly suggest people learn what is the concept of acting evil in this world or being sinful in this world or being a scorner. And then the more elevated level is after we've tried to make, and again, we are all works in progress, what do we do to correct ourselves to avoid being in that three categories of human beings? And then when we're really strong enough, how can we approach, not necessarily on a group level, but say someone we know who is in that category, and we're not being judgmental, saying, oh, that's just a wicked person. It could be a person who never got the proper education. They could have had a traumatic life event that causes them to go in the wrong way. So this is the type of thing we're talking about here as it relates to this teaching of Rabbi Nachman, to understand correctly as much as we can what is the truth of the matter and how to implement it in our daily lives. And again, what, and I'm saying this, not, this is not what he brings out, to see what can we do to try to help another person stay away from being scornful, staying away from sinful acts, staying away from wicked acts. Dennis, your take on this attribute of trying to seek out the straightness or the straight path that can be afforded one who seeks a spirituality if they're trying to glean from the Torah teachings.
Unfortunately, in the English vernacular of today, the word straight means you're not crooked. I think a better term would be direct, not just straight, but direct, because
okay.
You don't want any interference, distractions, or other things. So why pay attention to those small little things when you're looking at a higher and more important goal than those little things or little speed bumps in life that are on the road? So we must concentrate on why we're on the road, not how well the road was built and if there's speed bumps or other little potholes along the way. So what we must do is concentrate on what our goal is, and we must do that and reinforce it every day. So, yes, we have choices, we have free will, but if you are not committed to a goal, a long-run goal, then what road are you on?
Ron, your take on this teaching from the Perkei Avos?
When you brought the Psalms in, and I decided to take a look at that, and it said the man that walked not in the counsel of the wicked or stood or sat. And as I'm looking at this, I realize walking is very, it's not a permanent thing. It's you're passing by, and it's more like a glimpsing thought. And then standing is like actually the faculty of speech, because it takes, you must stop to see. You must, speech is a little bit more than just walking by. And then sitting means it's actually like an action where you actually bring it into the permanence. So as I'm looking, I feel that we have to acquire some kind of a measure before we can be able to differentiate, you know, that which is crooked and that which is straight, because normally depends a lot on your environment, your upbringing, as you said before, and our personal shortcomings and what we would excuse and what we won't. And first we have to develop this, and not according to ourselves, but according to what is right. Because what is right many times is relative to a person's upbringing or their, you know, whatever influences them. So I really feel that we first have to acquire that knowledge of what is right first, foremost. Then we have to adhere to that, and then we are able to differentiate the right from the wrong as it comes to make the right choices.
Beautiful. Okay, I mean, yeah, I mean, you know, it's very interesting how the verse, the beginning of Psalm starts out, that again, King David gives strong advice to avoid these three categories of human beings engaging in those, negative experiences. And then by the second verse he says, but rather, so if a person, which I think also is in the spirit
of the 7 Noahic Commandments, and certainly in the spirit of the 613 Commandments of Israel, we have accepted upon ourselves the last 3,323 plus years. So if we're going to not go in the advice of the wicked or the ways of the sinners, or we won't stand in that area where they are, and in the sitting places of the scornful we won't sit, but rather to engage in the Torah, the instructions of the Almighty, should be a desire. And then in his Torah, a person should want to meditate upon it on day and night. So I was thinking about this, that very interesting, that why wouldn't you start with the positive, and from there, which is the gathering of knowledge, and then know that these three categories of people you should try to avoid. Well, perhaps we do know, I think it's in a later chapter in Psalms, I think it might be 34, where King David said, turn from evil. Yeah, in chapter 34, verse 15, turn from evil and do good and seek peace and pursue it. So we do see here that's where, you know, Dennis talked about, you know, he alluded to the idea that we should avoid static presentations of teachings, that we should, you know, a true teaching is something which is dynamic and ongoing, and those teachings which existed before the Common Era, say the teachings of Galen, the Greek doctor, Hippocrates or Aristotle, or any other, the ancients of the Noahides or the ancients of Israel, those obviously were not static teachings because we're still talking about those teachings today. And here King David, who lived 2,700 years ago, maybe 2,800 years ago, was telling us back then, on the one hand, avoid three categories of human beings. At the same time, too, on a personal level, we have to turn from evil and do good. And what comes out of that? We should seek peace and pursue it. So ultimately, I think that King David is telling us, yes, you should avoid those three categories of people. But once you've started to get some sort of handle on doing good and seeking peace and pursue it, eventually your pursuit of true peace will lead you back to hopefully engaging with those three categories of human beings, that they can, in fact, change their ways. And of course that will require a lot of dialogue. And here's a concept, gentlemen, that I want to share with you, which perhaps I think that the three major faiths, Christianity, Islam, and Judaism, I still don't know how to get a handle on it in a way that it should lead to universal fellowship among the Jewish people and the Islamic people and the Christian people. But guess who wrote it? Our dynamic teacher, Rambam. So I'm going to share it with you. I don't know if you've heard this teaching, Ron. I know Ron is aware of it. So I'll read it. This is from Rambam's Mishneh Torah, Law of Kings. And this is the 11th chapter and the 4th law. So all these things concerning Jesus the Nazarene and Muhammad the Ishmaelite, who rose after him, only served to pave the way for the Messianic King, who will perfect the whole entire world and bring all men to serve God in unison. It has thus been predicted, quote, for then I will convert the nations to a pure language, that they may call upon the name of God and serve him with a common accord, end quote. And that's in Zephaniah, I guess you would say in English, chapter 3, verse 4. And all nations will turn to true faith and no longer steal and oppress. Together with Israel, they will eat that which they have honestly gained. And this is what Isaiah means when he says, quote, the lion shall eat straw like the ox, end of quote, and that's in Isaiah chapter 11, verse 7. All prophecies such as these regarding the Messiah are allegorical. Only in the Messianic era we will know the meaning of each allegory and what it comes to tell us or teach us. Our sages and prophets did not long for the Messianic era in order that they may rule the world and dominate the Gentiles. They did not desire that the nation should honor them or that they should eat, drink, and be merry. They only desired one thing, to be free to involve themselves in the Torah and its wisdom. They wanted nothing to disturb them or distract them, in order they may become worthy of life in the world to come. In the Messianic era, there will be neither war nor famine. Jealousy and competition will cease to exist. For all good things will be plentiful, and all sorts of delicacies will be common as dust. Humanity's main occupation will be only to know God. The nation of Israel will become a nation of great sages, knowing many hidden things and attaining the greatest possible, the greatest understanding of God possible for a human being. And the prophet Isaiah thus predicted, quote, the earth shall be filled of the knowledge of God as the water covers the sea. That's in Isaiah 11:9. And Lubavitcher Rebbe, the seventh Lubavitcher Rebbe, said that this is not just an exclusive elitist club for the Israelites. This is actually this prophecy in Isaiah that the earth shall be full of the knowledge of God as the waters cover the earth, sea. This also includes the entire human family. Dennis, thoughts, questions, and concerns about this teaching, and why is it so hard for the three major faiths to realize that we were only created in order to bring about the actualization of human existence to a redemptive state?
The reason why they can't come together is that they emphasize the differences, and their differences are not that important. God is far more important than their differences, but they don't understand this. They want to hold on to what they think they have gained, or from a human viewpoint, what position they are in the world. We are minuscule compared to the power of God.
Thank you. Ron, why do you think the three major faiths are struggling with this idea that we're all of us are here together to bring in, to usher in this universal redemption?
I think we all have to remember first of all what we need. We are children of one God. That's the first thing. And that we are all... One second. We are all... we all are put here for a purpose, and we have to work together to... I'm sorry, I just have to move from one location to the next.
No problem. Take your time.
And we all have our purpose here in this world, and it's one God that gave us the as our personality part, our differences, and it's all for the benefit of mankind in general. And me personally, I feel that it's because of a lack of knowledge, and I think there is where everything stands, because sort of pure ignorance that we have these separations and differences, and everyone is trying or trying to think they're better than the other. And in Christianity and Islam, they are both derived from Judaism to begin with. As a result, I feel that there should be a certain acknowledgement of where the origin of their spiritual beliefs came from. And I don't know. I really can't put my thoughts together. Once I start moving, I lost track. Sorry.
Okay. Well, I think so. Listen, I think everyone has been caught with their hand in the cookie jar, whether it be of the Christian faith, whether it be of the Islamic faith, the Jewish faith. That, you know, unfortunately, I mean, again, when Dennis has been reading these teachings about Rambam and that period. Whether he was in Spain or in Egypt, I think there was a golden opportunity to control the fire of the differences between the three main faiths. And unfortunately, the flames were turned up, and then we had the Crusades, and then we had the incursions of the Islamic faith as either a proactive approach to trying to conquer the world and then of Islam, or in a reactive fashion when the Christians tried to, you know, their ultimate goal was to go into Jerusalem, and there are accounts that, you know, they were trying to confiscate the treasures that King Solomon had buried, or had actually created a whole sophisticated series of caverns underneath which is the remains of the Holy Temple. And so there were traditions that they can get this stuff. In the meantime, that as they would travel from northern or western or eastern Europe, that unfortunately anyone who got in their crossfire were made as target practice until they would have their clashes with the Islamic people. And our dilemma as the Jewish people from that period onward until the Middle Ages, until basically about 30 years ago, is that if we were trying to spread, say, the teachings of the Torah, and especially the Noahide commandments, well, we could be burned at the stake
for taking people away from the Christian or the Islamic perspective of them having the true faith or the adopted new faith. So it's not a simple matter. I could not have solved that. I could not have provided the solution 800, 900, 1,000 years ago. But I'm here today just to reflect that there are such teachings which existed from, of course, you know, the Rambam is the one who tried to, that was his effort to try to bring the three faiths together, to say, guys, listen, we have a lot in common. Also, I want to bring together, before we move on to the next section, which is the path to rise of Gentile, and again, I'm pulling from Compassion for Humanity in the Jewish Tradition, Rabbi Yaakov Emden and his commentary on the Ethics of the Father, Chapter 4, Teaching 13. And this, again, this is a very, very powerful teaching. I think these type of messages have to go out to the nations to get us together before, you know, there's some people promoting there has to be a war before Mashiach comes. Yet Rabbi Nachman, whose teachings we taught, we shared before, saying that you don't need to fire a gun to bring Mashiach. So we have this clash of conscience between those who say there has to be an end times with an end war, and there's a minority who say you don't need a gun to bring Mashiach. And this is one of the teachings, I think, that will help us realize we don't need a gun to bring Mashiach. This is the following teaching by Rabbi Yaakov Emden. It goes like this. Christians and Muslims must be regarded as an instrument for the fulfillment of the prophecy that the knowledge of God will one day spread throughout the earth. Whereas the nations before them worshipped idols, denied God's existence, and did not recognize God's power or his retribution, the rise of Christianity and Islam served to spread among the nations to the farthest ends of the earth the knowledge that there is one God who governs the world, who rewards and punishes and reveals himself to man. Christian scholars have not only won acceptance among the nations for the revelation of the written law, which is the Torah, but Christian scholars have helped to safeguard God's oral law, the Talmud and rabbinic tradition. For in their hostility to the Torah, ruthless persons in their own midst sought to abrogate and uproot the Talmud. Others from among their faith arose to defend it and to repulse these attempts to destroy the oral and written Torah. And that was Rabbi Yaakov Emden. Dennis, your thoughts, questions, or concerns about this teaching by Rabbi Emden?
I don't think that people were looking to destroy anything that originated out of the Bible or the Talmud. I think they may have created interpretations, they may have created questions, and dichotomies may have arose, but what happens is we all have our basic faith in common with one God, and we believe in his goodness and his teachings. So therefore, anything that was written prior or even discussed orally has some value. But the value of that only depends on what you use it for today, because we're worried about our future. We're not worried about what would happen to us if we were living in the past. So we must present ourselves to God as to what we're doing today and what we plan to do tomorrow, and the next day.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful. Ron, your take on this teaching by Rabbi Emden?
I was reading something on HaTorah.org recently about being addicted to evil. And it concerned one where a person puts another down to feel important. And many times, what brings about a lot of the problems that we have is that when one person, whether it be religion or a concept or whatever, instead of showing its greatness, decides to belittle its competition, as it may feel, and show where it's basically of no value to enhance its own value, and doing that only brings strife. Unfortunately, that is what's been taking place, you know, among the religions in the past, and it has affected us tremendously now, because some people can't even release their minds from this type of mentality. As a result, what happened in the past, it's continuing now. Actually, it bears fruit today, where we have this tremendous animosity. And one point I read only yesterday in the Torah anthology, it said that you know, the Creator revealed himself and his message in front of the entire nation of people.
Mm-hmm.
But for some reason, there's these individuals who says his message has changed. And only by right, if you're changing your message, you should gather all the witnesses or all the nations and relinquish
right.
the original message. And this never happened again. So we just have to stick with what the original message is. And, you know, eventually we'll see what, you know, what will come out from that.
True. Okay, gentlemen, let's move on. And if any blessed souls are listening out there, I hope you are. You'll hear the archive version. If you want to try to make the show a little more organic, you can call in at 347-838-8669. That's 347-838-8669. We're moving on to the Path of the Gentile, Chapter 3. This is the chapter on returning to God. And this is Part 2, Paragraph 1, page 29. And this book was authored by Rabbi Chaim Klorfin and Rabbi Yaakov Rogalski. It goes like this. If a person has transgressed one or all of the 7 Noahide commandments, either willfully or unintentionally, when he or she repents, he or she is obligated to confess verbally, specifying his or her sins before the God of kindness, blessed be he. And how should he confess? He should speak words to the effect. And this following supplication I'm sharing with you, blessed souls, is coming from the teachings of our dynamic teacher, Rambam, who uses the following language. I beseech you, God, I have sinned unintentionally, or I have transgressed willingly. I have acted out of spite before you, and I have done such and such. I regret my actions and am ashamed of them and will not do such and such again. And the Rambam, this is taking from the Rambam's laws of return, of laws of repentance, Hilchot Tshuva. This is the essence of confession. And anyone who increases the content of his confession, his or her confession, and elaborates upon it is praiseworthy. Now, does a person have to, you know, get a script? Of course not. But every person has a unique relationship with the Almighty. Therefore, this is something which is suggested, this particular type of expression of contrition, regret, and feeling bad about rebelling against the Most High by transgressing one of the 7 High Commandments. But again, the emphasis here, according to the Rambam, is anyone who increases the content of his confession and elaborates upon it is praiseworthy. And I read into it, gentlemen, and then I'll ask Dennis and Rhonda give their own perspective, is that this allows the individual to develop that personal relationship, just as we develop a personal relationship with the Most High through our prayers to him, outside of the idea that we're praying for forgiveness, we're praying for our needs, and we're praying him to praise him, that it allows a person to get a unique inner perspective of how they can actually feel empowered by repenting to make serious, quantifiable, tangible, significant changes in their life through the human experience of, you know, we said before, ohev et amasharim, to love which is direct. If we understand that God directly created the world, we realize if we've done something wrong, we can directly communicate back to him at our time, you know, as time permits us, to ask for forgiveness for the mistakes we've made. Dennis, your take on this?
Contrition. Contrition is part of exercising our human humility in the face of the Lord. We must be sincere, and we must be able to send the words from our heart in supplication to the Almighty. And if he believes us, he will take care of us. But if you're not true to yourself, and if you don't use heartfelt type of feelings that humans do have, you're not going to get the message across. If you think it's a simple format, if you think it's a series of words that you can repeat, if you think it's something that was written down a long time ago and you're only going to voice it and that's going to be sufficient, be prepared, because you cannot fool the Almighty. If you said you're sorry, you must mean it. but you must add the other half, and that is, I'll try not to do it again. You can say you promise not to do it again, but you're human. So because of that, you'll probably end up doing it again, but you must repent. And in that repentance must be a clean contrition.
John, your take on this matter?
When I first came across this teaching, I understood the asking for forgiveness for what you did, and you're not going to do it again, and everything else like that, except for that portion that says, anyone who increases the context of his confession and elaborates upon it, it is praiseworthy. That I couldn't quite mesh until recently. I realized that when a person says they wouldn't, let's say, okay, I wouldn't steal again, for example, what's happening is he's just mentioning just the theft, but not the idea that brought him to that place to begin with. And here is where the Rambam says the elaboration is praiseworthy, because when you elaborate and you go back to the heart of why you stole to begin with, then when you make that declaration of not doing it again, you'll understand what brought you to that to begin with and avoid that part of the sin to begin with. And as a result, I understand why that makes it praiseworthy, because it's more of an honest and an inner decision not to transgress this sin any longer. Because just saying you just committed a sin and you're not going to do it again, you know, you're just feeling superficially. And even though this be accepted by the Creator, we'll find ourselves in a situation again a little bit different, and we can fall right back into the same behavior again, because we are, of course, creatures of habit. And once you've gotten to this point where you break a commandment, that means you've been habitually on this path, and we must get to the source of why we did this to begin with. I think this is the elaboration that really helps us to connect to the Creator on that inner level.
And true, you know, and the thing is, too, is what, and now this is a spiritual path we're talking about, Dennis and Ron and Dennis, and any blessed souls or souls that are listening out there, that this is also a primary means of therapeutic awareness, that I myself, being involved in the mental health field and helping people with developmental delays, is to try to help the person realize what is the underlying cause of the behavior. I mean, I deal with all different types of people, and many times people are angry, but they're not angry at myself. They're not angry at, say, someone else who they vent their verbal anger against. They're angry because there's an unresolved issue, and because they have not been given the emotional empowerment, unfortunately, in their upbringing, that they adapt, and unfortunately, they absorb negative behaviors and negative thoughts, negative speech, because they hear it from other people, and every person is a miniature world unto themselves. Every person is a microcosmic reflection of the universe. So when a little microcosmic reflection of the universe exemplifies something negative to another person, but it seems to be a positive thing to do, with, like an in-the-moment type of just freebie type of experience, of course there are everything. Nothing is really for free. Everything is just on the one hand is a gift, but there are implications, repercussions for our actions. But this idea of repentance by going into the elaboration, well, actually, from a mental health level as well, I wish to add. I mean, I don't want to say the Torah's prescription for going in the wrong pathway is the key to mental health, because it's a much deeper experience. But since we experience spirituality and intellectual awareness, and as well our mental health awareness, hopefully mental health wellness, that this ties into all three types of experiences that we can have, you know, upon this earth. And I think it's very important to realize that the Torah does not just want us to be spiritual beings. We have to live life in a very, very physical, emotional, intellectual, spiritual level. So it's really a kind of, I would say, a more accurate depiction of this type of repentance, of confessional action or speech, matters of the heart, matters of the mind, matters of the tongue and lips, is that it's to address all different levels at once. Gentlemen, with that being said, now we're about 9 minutes away to the end of today's show, which I am truly enjoying. Meditations of gratitude to the Most High, because we are all indigenous descendants of the dust, and we had a living soul breathed into us. And I think this will be the probably the last week that we're going to go into these meditations of gratitude, and hopefully with the Most High's blessing, we'll go into chapter 2, verse 8 in Genesis. Another gratitude, expression of gratitude is always trust in God. Do not hesitate to give charity because you fear monetary loss. Remember that God always does good and never seeks to injure a person. Now, at the same time, too, we must caution everyone. This is not the Torah's and the oral Torah prescription that a person should drive him or herself into poverty through the act of charity. But we're talking about money which is available to you, which is sort of speak in the middle between pampering yourself or empowering another person. And only the most pious of people should attempt to give charity on a level where potentially it could in fact bring up the question if they are injuring themselves financially or emotionally, spiritually, intellectually. So we're going to say this teaching with an asterisk: give what you can, but don't give into the point where you yourself become in need of charity. Dennis, your reflections on this teaching.
If you know everything, you don't need God, because you know everything. However, we don't know everything, and you're never going to find out everything. And that leaves the door open to faith and belief. You must have something additional within yourself to be complete. If you really want to be at peace with yourself, you must open up those doors that allow you to accept faith and belief, because those are the answers that will help you get through for things you don't know, because you may never know. But you must believe in something and have the faith that you are on the right track, the direct road to God.
Ron? Any reflections on this meditation coming out of Torah anthology, rooted in the verse, chapter 2, verse 7 in Genesis?
Hey, how you doing?
I have to go back to the Shmoneh Perikim, where it says that the amount that the person gives is not of the essence of giving, but it's the consistency of giving, which changes the person on the inner aspect. So many times we feel, you know, to be charitable or to give means we have to give significant sums of money, which can sometimes, you know, lead to our own financial problems. But it's a constancy of giving on a constant level which brings about that change in us. And normally people, a giver receives to give. So once we become givers, we are also receivers. And we're receiving from the Most High. So it's a cycle, basically, we create. So you shouldn't have that fear that you will end up becoming impoverished unless you're doing this out of you're just giving away because of a heightened emotional euphoric state where you just give massive sums of money away without, you know, contemplating the meaning behind the giving. So, basically, the advice from the Rambam is what I hold as in terms of you give constantly, and instead of just a one-time, you know, massive amount where when you financial break.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful. Our last meditation, we kind of wind down today's show. So the Torah anthology employs us, and this will be the last meditation on this series of meditations of gratitude to the Most High for taking us out of the dust of the earth and breathing into us a living soul. Picture yourself as a refugee in a strange city where you have no friends. Yet, the king has mercy on you and gives you a place to live and enough food for your daily needs. He also sets you up in a business where you can make a good profit through merchandise that he gives you. But the king commands you not to sell on credit without his permission and not to take any loans, saying that if you obey his orders, he will act kindly towards you, and if not, you will be punished. So certainly you will act honestly and obey the king's orders, aware of what the king has done. After all, you're a refugee in a strange city. No one knows you. And aware that what the king has done for you is that you should not be so proud. You are a stranger in a foreign land, and every day you would bless the king for the good he did for you and praise him. Of all the people in this city, he was the only one who showed any concern for you. You should not seek to gain any status since you are a refugee, and everything that you have is a gain. All the while, you must make a provision for the future. You are a foreigner, and you never know when the king will demand that you leave and go back to your original home. And these are the type of things, so this is allegorical, referring to the fact that we are sent into this world, and in a sense, although we are born of flesh and blood parents, we are, in a sense, on our own as an individual living out and experiencing only their unique human experiences, which no one else can experience. And therefore, if we act in this way, realizing that we are truly being provided by the King of all creation, the Almighty One, certainly we will seek to act out in a way that is proper, because one day he will send us back to where we came from, which is our true state of being, where our soul originally was, until, of course, it will be revealed through the Messianic era that the Most High's true intention of putting us into this world is that we have rectified this world, improved, elevated this world, and at the time of the Great Resurrection, we will make this earth truly our eternal home. Dennis, do you have any comments, concerns about this type of teaching?
Well, wealth and riches lead to greed and mammon to a certain extent. However, the currency that the Almighty deals with is faith, spirituality, and belief. And we must understand that the specie that we use for money is only a human convention. And we must keep it that way and not to extend it as though it's something that we believe in and will follow. We must be able to contain our humanity. And the one thing that we have to worry about is too much riches and wealth will create excuses or give us substitutions to deviate from the Lord.
Ron, can you make your... First of all, thank you, Dennis. You'd like to make your conclusive statement.
We have to always keep in mind the statement, by the power of my arm, I've acquired what I have. And we should always remember that this is actually a gift from the Creator, because he's the one that gave us the power of the arm to begin with.
Beautiful. I'd like to thank Dennis Ryan and Ron Williams and any of you blessed souls who have heard the live version of today's Soul Class, number 143, In Search of Ancient Authentic Torah. So I'll give everyone a homework assignment to please look up Genesis chapter 2, verse 8. Hopefully we'll reconvene next week, probably at 8 o'clock in the evening. We're going to sign off with Listen Up, My Soul, by our good friend Achi David Dome from England, who helps us take us home to reconnect to our divine image, to help us get off the scrimmage, to tell them, Elohim, it is no dream. Have a blessed week, everyone. Take care.
Well.
Thank you.